God sometimes says no, not because he's mad. He withholds no good thing from you, the Bible says. So when he says no, it's a good thing. You may not know what it is, but you will in time.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the show. On behalf of Discipleless City, I'm Todd Carlton, and this is the Toddcast. Follow the podcast on Instagram at the Toddcast _DAC. And for more information about Discipleless City, how you and your church, organization, or group can become trained in evangelism and discipleship, visit our website at discipleesscity.ca. To be encouraged by what God is doing, download the United Hive app. You can wake up every day to testimonies of how God is moving across the world. Download the United Hive app today. My friends, today we are on location on the shores of Lake Ontario at the Lakeshore Pentecostal Camp. My guest today is originally from Tulsa, Oklahoma. He's living in Sarasota, Florida, studied at Oral Roberts University. He's written 99 books and is most known for the God's General series. He preaches all over the world and is a historian sharing the stories of all God's fantastic people. He's here in Canada speaking for the week at this camp. Please welcome Dr. Roberts Lairdon.
Good to be with you all again.
Hey, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to speak to us today.
It's good to be here. I'm glad you're out here with the camp with us.
Yeah.
Is it your first time at the camp?
It is our first time at the camp.
I called it a glam camp. I used to go to church camps and they were suffering enduring camps. This is a nice camp. So I like this camp. I could do this one again.
Yeah, it's very nice. Haven't made it to the beach yet, but it's very nice. What about that train? I don't know if people can hear the train
about
there.
Three times a day, so it's just a part of the uniqueness of the camp experience.
Does it come through in the middle of the night?
It does come through at nighttime sometime, yeah. But I'm a missionary, so I've learned to sleep through all noises, and it don't bother me as much as maybe do other people.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah.
And you had spoken at a local church before this, and prior to that, you were in the UK.
I was in the UK and Germany before I came here to be at the camp. And so that was, let's see, it was my first time back in the UK since COVID. I've been back to Germany, so it was my trip. I usually go there once or twice a year. Yeah.
So you quite a full summer for you.
Yeah, summers I work. And so I'm all over. So I'm not teaching college or the Bible college in Dawsonville. So in the summer, I can just go and roam and stay as long as I want. And I go to big places and little places and easy places and difficult places to get to. Like the place I went in Germany was a 3-hour drive from Frankfurt, Germany. So I had to get off the plane after I flew across the ocean and then drive 3 hours.
Wow.
So I think that's Jesus stuff. He goes everywhere. Sometimes it is a little difficult, but you still go.
Yeah. And so throughout the rest of the year, you're teaching and speaking.
Yeah, I'm teaching usually on Tuesday nights, September through December, at the Bible College there in North Georgia in Dawsonville. And then I travel the weekends because the Atlanta airport is so nice. It has one-way trips all over the world. You have to do all those connections, so it's quite easy to get in and get back.
Okay.
Or get in and get out, I should say.
So what about holidays? When do you get to rest?
Christmas. The holiday for me is going home.
Yeah.
A holiday for me is not having a schedule where I have to be dressed or ready by 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock or something. So I actually have a whole day without nothing on the schedule. That's great for me.
So we say you live in Sarasota, but I guess you're not really spending heaps of time in Sarasota. No, then.
During the summer when I'm home, I just came from there. It's been a week after I come back from Germany. And then I usually, during the school year, I have a second home or an apartment up in Dawsonville, Georgia. So I usually base out of there because it's easier just to use the airport that way.
Oh, awesome.
So I live an unusual life. It's not your typical Monday to Friday kind of lifestyle.
Which is all right.
Yeah. I've been doing it since I was 17 years old, so I'm 58. So I've been in it for a long time.
Well used to it.
Yeah. I know how to live out of a suitcase more than I do a dresser in a closet.
You probably know the right foods, what to and not to eat at an airport.
I'm a restaurant chain connoisseur. So I know what to eat as I travel across the country, what restaurants like and which one I don't like. So,
what about the Waffle House down the
U.S.?
That's
where you have to go, not where you plan to go.
Only went there once.
It's where you have to go.
Oh, boy, it's greasy. Hey,
it is not where you want to spend a lot of time.
Yeah. So, yeah, let's talk about you in the very beginning, growing up in Oklahoma, and have heard some of your story. We like to do a little research on people. So we know you always grew up in the church. Yeah. And loved it. And that was really interesting to me because a lot of people grow up in the church, but they drift.
Yeah.
But it just, you loved it and were always there. Yeah.
I jokingly say I was born again. And I say that because I don't remember a day that Bible, prayer, God, and church was not a part of my life. The story I'm told that when I was born, we left the hospital on a Wednesday. And they took me to church first. So I went straight from being born to the church house. I didn't go home. I went to church. And they tell me that three of the older, heavy-set grandmother ladies grabbed me in the foyer and prayed over me then. And then we went into service. And the pastor said, since the family's all here, let's dedicate him tonight. So I got prayed for by the old praying grandmothers, dedicated to the Lord on my first place on earth. So I never had a chance to do anything else but God, Jesus, church, and meetings. So, but I didn't rebel against it. The thing that made it work for me was Jesus was bigger in our home than he was in our church. And then that's not a negative, that's a positive. Because you live in your home more than you go to church. And so for us, Jesus was the unseen visitor or the unseen person in our home. And so we just grew up like that. We didn't know it any different. We prayed every night about 7:30. I'm sure we missed some nights, but I don't remember those nights. So we had family prayer. And when we were relearning our multiplication tables, 2 times 2 is 4 and all that kind of stuff, we'd also have scriptures we'd have to learn, references or the verses. So we were learning all the stuff at the same time as part of our homework process. So my family made growing up spiritually a part of growing up academically. So it was a part of our life. I did not know that we were different or special until I began traveling around the nation at 17, 18 years old. When I realized, oh, people don't live like this. And then I realized it wasn't odd. It was special. It was something that made us a very unique family. And I benefited by it. I did not reject it. I did not reject God. I did not reject the church, even though there were things that you see as you grow up in the church. It's not good. Things happen in the church. We did not have that affect us because our home life was stronger than the church. Most people's home life is weaker. And so what happens to the church and all that, it affects them the other way.
Right.
So it didn't bother us. We got through it. Our rule of thumb, we don't leave a church when it's in trouble. We leave a church if we're going to leave when it's in peace. And we've only been part of 4 churches in my whole life. And I'm 58. So we weren't charismatics. We didn't jump from church to church because we didn't like the guest speaker or the last sermon or they didn't like the song. Or we didn't do that. We stayed. And so we were that kind of consistent kind of people. And that built a stability in our spiritual life as kids, me and my sister.
Yeah. So now, also in your testimony, my parents separated when I was young. So as you shared in yours, yours did as well.
When I was 5 and a half.
Yeah. So that obviously also, what was that like for you as a little guy?
Well, growing up, back in those days, divorce and single parenting was still new. It wasn't a major part of culture. This was about in the 70s. It was just beginning to be accepted, if you want to say it that way. So growing up like that, my father, on my father's side, were alcoholics and adulterers. When we go back into our family tree on that side to grandpa and that side, that's what they all were challenged with. My dad had gotten saved, met my mother, and helped my grandparents in some of their tent meetings and things like that. And so we didn't know much about generational curses. We didn't know some of that stuff that we know today. If we'd have known it, we could have helped some stuff. So the divorce happened because of some of those issues. And then I grew up with like Timothy in the Bible, with a mother and a grandmother. Timothy's mother's name was Lois and Eunice. Mine was Carol and Gladeline. And so I grew up with a strong grandmother-mother influence with an absence of a father. So you have the absence of a father problems, challenges, because you don't have that reference. You don't have that role model in the home. So that was a challenge. But overall, we survived it. We came up, and to be honest, we got the left foot of fellowship in the church. There were some, well, your parents are divorced, and you're this kind of person. They didn't reject us, but they kind of put us in a certain category. And you could feel that placement. But I was the only one in the youth group that became anything, to be honest with you. Hmm. I was the only one that, you know, became what I've become. And it was because of how we prayed and what we did. And so my grandmother told me, make God your dad and you'll be okay. And that's what I did. and we went forward.
Your grandmother, hugely influential. Can you share about her blocking the door?
Yes. You want to go through all those stories?
I like that one.
Well, my grandmother and grandparents were Assemblies of God preachers in the Carolinas, and they were country preachers. And my grandfather died when I was a year old, so I never, there's pictures of him holding me, but I have no memory of him. My grandmother continued to pastor the church after he passed, and, you know, was happy to do that. And when my mom and dad divorced, my mom called my grandmother and said, would you come here and help me raise Robertson Priscilla while I finish my college education, Orbert University? And so she prayed, and the Lord told her, if you will go and help raise Robert Priscilla, you'll have more fruit for me out of them two than you will your whole church. And so she resigned the church and moved to Tulsa, where we were. And Grandma never stopped preaching. She preached at breakfast. She preached at lunch. She preached at dinner. And she put you to bed and turned on a Kent Hagin tape while you went to sleep. You heard Brother Hagin preach. That's how I grew up. And so Grandmother prayed every day about 11 o'clock. 10, 11 o'clock was her prayer time. She'd been doing that since she was 17 years old. So during the summertime, we'd have to pray with her, which meant we would go to the bathroom, get my little trucks, Priscilla would get her dolls or coloring books, and we'd go in her bedroom, and she would kneel in front of the door so we could open it and get out while she was praying. And so after a while, you're in the room, and you're praying, playing with your trucks and Priscilla with her dolls or whatever. And then after a while, the only thing entertaining is watching Grandma pray, because you just didn't have cell phones, and you couldn't get out, and you couldn't do anything, because you did anything wrong, you got a spanking when it was all over. And so you sit there, and you watch her. And that's where we learned about the Spirit and the anointing and the counters of that presence when we were little. We knew when Grandma would be praying in the Spirit or praying in tongues, when it would change gears, we'd call it, and it would get stronger or whatever you want to, however you want to explain that. If you were close to her, your goosebumps would get bigger.
Wow.
And that's how, as little kids, we would say, is she about to do that? Is she going to do it now? Because we'd try to get close to her, because when she'd do that, you could feel that power go over you, and that's how we begin to be addicted or become aware of the presence of the Lord as little kids. And by the time I was a teenager, we could also pray a couple hours with her without even stopping, because they taught us to pray and they helped build the muscle inside to pray along if you needed to. So they started us with a kitchen timer. We didn't have, you know, iPhones with the timer on. Then we had kitchen timers and microwaves is what we had with the timer. And they would set the timer in the beginning for about 2.5 minutes. You prayed in English out loud. And then you said it again for 2.5 minutes and you prayed in tongues out loud. So when we conquered 5 minutes, they turned it to 10. And every time we could conquer it real comfortably, they'd change it. So at the time we were 14 or 15, we could pray 2 or 3 hours and it'd be no problem. And it wasn't a deal. It was just we could do it because we'd built the muscle. So we weren't special people. We just developed ourselves. We were developed in the things of the Lord the right way, and it worked. And I didn't rebel, nor my sister rebel against it. We actually liked it and appreciated it and valued it as a child would in their own kind of way.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. Prayer is so powerful. Yeah. Right? So when you got older, late teens, when did you actually start sort of speaking or feel called by the Lord to do something in vocational ministry?
My call came to me when I was 8 years old. I knew that was what I was supposed to do at age 8. At 12 and a half, I preached my first sermon. And then at 17, I wrote my first book and released it at 17 and a half or so. Sold 1.5 million copies the first year. So I went from an unknown person to whom? Overnight, when I was still in high school, a very known personality in Tulsa and in the Word of Faith revival. And so my life is not how you normally do life. My life was lived differently, because how I was trained so early. I was developed in the Word and the Spirit and the flow of the Holy Ghost. So by the time I was that age, I could be a speaker. And so by the time I was 17, 18 years old, I was doing camp meetings across America and hitting all the big national camp meetings. In my time, I was 20. In my early 20s, I was international. So I'm not your normal way things happen, but I wasn't raised to be a normal child. I was raised to be a strong spiritual person that obeyed the Lord, and I became that.
Well, and I've heard you speak, so I can vouch for that, too.
I hope it's working.
can you frame when you were eight and you knew you were called at eight, can you kind of put to words or frame what that experience was like?
Mine was an encounter. I don't talk much about of a heaven experience. I was 8 years old and I went to heaven. And I know it sounds crazy. Back when that happened, I didn't tell anybody for many years because I didn't want to be the weird, odd person. At the end of that experience or that moment, the call came to me. And Jesus stood in front of me, said, I'm sending you back to earth to preach while they yet call you young. And he spoke the word go three times. Go, go, go. And that go drives me today. So most of you have one go. I have three. So if you watch my schedule, how I do what I do, there is a momentum that some people can't keep up with. And it's probably because of that command or that utterance that went into me. And so that's how it came to me. So today people have more heaven experiences. They have more encounters and visions and dreams than they did when I was 8 years old. So that was a rare thing. And so when I finally begin to, I wrote that in a little book, a little testimony book. That's the one I wrote first that sold so much. I didn't know it would do that. I didn't want to tell the story. I still hesitate because it's private, it's personal, and it's mine. I'll say that it's my story. It's what happened to me. But the Lord told me even to win more souls than I would. He says, you're not an evangelist, but this will be an evangelistic arm of your ministry. So that book goes out and wins souls and helps people with folks who have gone to heaven. So it's that arm that just reaches and keeps going all the time, that story.
Not weird for us. We like weird.
Okay.
And
today there's more of an acceptance of this
yeah.
than when I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
Because back then there were so few of us that would even say anything. And then you had to also have a death experience to have a heaven experience. I didn't die. I just went and came back.
Yeah.
It's one of those sovereign acts. And so, you know, I've always taken that. Here's what I saw. You don't have to believe me. If you do, great. If you don't, just make sure you get there to see that I'm right. Yeah. The way I kind of, you know, framed it. And that's the way that some people don't even know about that in my life because I don't make that a big deal today.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that with us. I've had people in previous episodes have, you know, some kind of an experience yeah. that seems similar in the fact that they didn't want to tell anybody, but yet it's so profound. So you're leading tent meetings across America as a teenager. What were the responses from people, like people that must have come to you to see somebody young? Because you can tell when somebody is anointed speaking yeah. versus somebody who's just a good speaker and well prepared.
Yeah. Yeah.
What were some of the feedback that you got from people?
Well, they used to introduce me as the youngest old man you'll ever meet. Is how they used to say, he's young, but when he talks, he sounds old. Now, what that was the age of my spirit that had been developed through my church and my home life and my personal discipline of welcoming that. So when spiritual aging does not have a limit to it, it has a request from you. The more time you give it, the faster you'll grow. Your body only ages at a certain pace. Your intellect can age a little bit faster, but it still has a limitation of what you can comprehend at the age you are. Spiritual aging is up to you. As much time you give to it is how fast you can grow. And so my spiritual age was a lot older than my biological and mental age. So when I stood up to speak, this thing came out and it enamored people. Like they couldn't figure it out. Like, how can you talk like a 40, 50 year old minister when he's only 20 years old or 18 years old? So they would come to see if it was real. And then the other thing that happened was I was classical Pentecostal. I had a prayer line. So prayer lines were fun for me. You cast out devils, you get people saved and spirit filled, you get them healed. And they would come to see what, because I was crazy. I didn't know you weren't supposed to do this. If you want prayer, come forward. And 400 people would show up. In those days, you prayed for them all yourself. You didn't have ministry teams. They're a lot nicer today to help you. Back then, you'd do it all yourself. The altar service may go an hour and a half because they'd want you to do it. And so we would pray for people. I would pray for people and all kinds of things would happen. Demons would scream and come out. And most people didn't see it like that in their churches and some of their camp meetings. But when I would show up, to me, it's just the way it's supposed to be. If it didn't happen, there was something wrong. And because of the strength that I was with the anointing on top of my human spirit strength, it exploded and not much freaked me out or pushed me back. I would press in and break through it. And so they would come. And a lot of the older saints loved it. The young people my age were enamored by it. The middle age was mixed between, I like him, but really? They were trying to find if there was if this was real or not. Well, time solves that problem. Hmm. You can't answer that. And say, well, it is real. Well, you're supposed to say that. So time tells the story to the skeptic. And so most of them I won in time. I'm still here at 58 doing the same thing. I was wilder when I was younger than I am today. It was also a different day. Like then I did all the prayer lines myself. Today you can have whole ministry teams to help you. And you can pray for more people that way. And it still works effectively. So it's a little bit of a different flow, but it's not. Well, it helps me at 58 not to get so exhausted. I still miss sometimes. Sometimes I want to do the whole thing myself and just say, we're going to be here a while and go at it. So that's my answer to your last question. So how's that?
That's great. That's great. So did you say 12 when you wrote your first book?
I was 17.
Yeah, you spoke first at 12. So let's talk about your books. What got you so interested in God's generals and all these people in the history?
I've had two dramatic encounters in my life. The 8-year-old heaven experience and the 12-year-old the general's experience. And this is the one I tell more often. I was watching Laverne and Shirley on television as a 12-year-old boy. I wasn't fasting. I wasn't praying. I wasn't being spiritual. I liked my Laverne and Shirley show. And Jesus walked through the front door of my house without opening the door and took about 3 steps toward me where I was sitting on the sofa like this. And all of a sudden, the room moved back to like 500 yards where you could barely hear the TV like in the distance, a little bit of the noise. And he said, study the lives of my generals. Know why they succeeded and why some failed. For there will come a generation who will want to know what I will show you if you will do what I tell you to do. And he said a few more things. And he turned around and walked back out the door. And I went back to watching TV. And I didn't like anything he said. Just to be honest with you and all the listeners, I didn't like anything he said. Because those words he spoke, I understood. Those are words that we were familiar with in our family, that kind of language. The word study meant I had to read books with no pictures in it. All right? So if you remember, in those days, you had to go to libraries.
Yeah.
Now, my mother would, there's three of us going to school in our family, my sister, me, and my mother. My mother would earn 2 masters and a doctorate. So many of the weekends when I wouldn't be out playing basketball or going to the movies with my friends, I would be in libraries. Mom would be studying. So that prepared me for my future. I knew how to work a library. I knew how to find a book. So when he said study, I knew what that meant. And then I knew he wanted me to study preachers, but I thought, how boring. Because my reference to most preachers then were fat, bald-headed preachers spit when they preached. Okay, that's what I grew up with. I'm exaggerating to a degree, but that was the gist of what they were. They weren't the great bonkies. Those kind of things were not in my frame of mind as a child or 12-year-old. And so, but we had a little belief. It's not scriptural, but it's a Christian belief that if you weren't doing what Jesus wanted you to do, you had an attitude, you didn't like it, and he came, you wouldn't go in the rapture. So that's not scripture. That's just called Pentecostal stuff I was around. So we had a small little library, probably maybe 3 or 4 shelves of books. And I went in and picked up one of the biographies that was happened to be in the family library. And I read it mainly so if Christ came that night, I could go in the rapture. Then that was my mindset. Okay, I know it's not sound doctrine, but that's what it was. And about when I was reading the second page or so of the second chapter, something happened to me. All of a sudden, the consuming desire to read and to want to know the story of different people that God chose and why and what they did took me over. And at this point, my librarian tells me I've read 14,000 plus books in my life so far.
Wow.
So now not all of them were big. Some were little pamphlets. So let's put them, but they were books. And I read books that you will never read. And I don't want you to read because it takes too much time. It's only one sentence worth reading the whole book, but you have to read the whole thing. I would read these books about preachers and movements and their teachings and consume. So when I went to school, I had my school books and a biography with my books in case in my math class or my science class, we'd be done early and we'd have 20 minutes or whatever else to do nothing. I'd read that book. And so I didn't play as much basketball. I still played some, but not like I did. All my social world kind of was shrunk to a point. And I became a little geek that read Christian books. I can say it like that. Little guy that has read Christian books. And I loved it. My mom thought, are you okay? Are you, there's something wrong. Is there an imbalance here? And they finally realized it was something the Lord had led me to do, and they supported it. And so I realized one day, too, when I was reading some of these books, like, you know, Wigglesworth's son is still alive. Kevin Kuhlman's secretary, Maggie, is having lunch somewhere. I want to talk to them. And I discovered there were people alive that knew some of these people that I was reading about. And I began to hunt them down. And being in Tulsa, where it was a great hub of Christian, full gospel Christian activity, Oral Roberts University, Rhema Bible Training Center, the big churches, had drawn people from all over the world of all ages there. And I began to find old ladies, because usually the men have died first. The old ladies that worked with Sister McPherson or knew Miss Kuhlman or saw Brother Wigglesworth and whatever. And I would go to their house with a tape recorder and a spiral on a piece of paper and ask questions and get them to talk. And at first, the old ladies and the old gentlemen were like, what's up with this guy? But then they tapped into it. It was more than just a unique oddity or a book report or a report you were doing for school on a personality you were supposed to do in social studies. And they begin to tell their friends, there's this little guy. His name's Robert. It's like Oral. And he likes this stuff. You should have him over. And we begin to go to these homes. I begin to go to their homes. And I always say my first dates in life are old women that knew famous dead preachers. And so, you know, that you go, when I always say, when you go on a date with an old lady, you don't go out to eat. She cooks for you. And you don't get a kiss. You get a prayer at the end of the night. And then, yeah, they do Pentecost. They pray for you and they go at you. And that's how I lived. And in those days, nobody cared about these people or these stories or the material. They begin to give me magazines and pictures and things like that that I didn't know existed. I didn't know that Amy had a magazine. I didn't know, here's Wigglesworth's Bible. They gave me, I mean, all kinds of stuff. They gave me stuff. Because when they died, their kids would throw it in the trash. And so they found in me somebody that valued this stuff. And they begin to give it to me. And I built one of the world's largest collections of revival memorabilia by accident. And so that's kind of how the Generals thing started. And I didn't know it would become what it's become. I am still, he's got the books here and the people bring me in all over the world to talk about this. And I'm like, I'm still humbled personally because I know where I come from. I know where I came from. I know where I come from. And none of this I could never put together. God took my little obedience to read the books and talk to the people and put it on the world stage. And I'm humbled every time I get up, like I talked about Oral Roberts this morning, and they clapped and cheered. I'm like, wow, I'm 58, and they're doing that for me on this subject, what they call history. And it's more a living, impactful history, because you can tell history and bore people to death, or you can make it come alive with the power. And that's what I try to do.
Yeah. Well, you definitely do that.
I try.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and have a very unique God-gifted way, I guess, of making it relatable today to the message that these people were preaching and for, you know, seeing revival today. Do you find that you're still learning some things about these people?
Learning. If you walk in my room over here today, you'll find in my room books I'm reading right now. So I'm keep reading. It's what I do all the time. I still read books. I still hunt old people. But now it comes to me, it's a little bit easier because the old folks go, I know somebody. And they'll give me their number. And so it continues. Back then I had to hunt them down.
Yeah.
And back then my mom would have to drop me off because I couldn't drive because I wasn't old enough to drive. So now I can drive myself and do things like that and fly across the world and do it. I'll go across the state or fly or say an extra day to go read a letter that somebody wrote about something. That's how, I won't say geekish, that's how intrigued I still am at 58. If I hear about a letter that Daddy Seymour wrote or Wigglesworth wrote in their handwriting that somebody has it, I will call to see if I can buy it or get it, or if I can't, can I come and read it? Because you never know what's in that letter. There could be another hint of something about their life that would be intriguing and powerful to tell a crowd or to tell one person that could change their life.
Yeah.
So I'm also the person that helps bring the anointing that they carried back into the present day earth to say this can still work, because what God did, he can do again, and he can do it bigger and louder. And it's supposed to be bigger and louder in every new generation. And so,
yeah, that's fascinating. So we're of the same generation. So it's intriguing today. And like you say, back then geeking or right type thing. How did your peers, your students, how did they treat you or while you were doing all that stuff?
Well, I went to public and private Christian high school education. So I was in the public school until my 10th grade. In my 11th and 12th grade, I went to Victory Christian School, which was the accredited Christian school at our church in Tulsa. And in the Christian school, my last 2 years, I became, at first, they didn't know what to do with me. And then my friends, the teachers, and the school realized this is a different kind of character. And they supported me. They wanted to understand. And they came alongside. And so I became an honored young old man in the school system. I would teach Bible class. Actually, I was teaching Bible college when I was 15 years old. So awesome. at the church I was at, so they have like 200-300 students. Some of my teachers that taught me math or algebra and social studies or government were in my class, and I taught them theology and Christian history, mainly revival history. So I was like that. So I would be going to math class, and then I'd go over to the college, which is in the next building, and teach a class, and my teacher would be in my class. So it was odd. And I would do theology schools. And at 15, I spoke at my first theology school on the generals because I knew more about Pentecostal people than the people teaching it, was what the dean of the college said, and made me a guest speaker from that day forward for years. So I would do it by memory. And so I would just ask who you want to know about. I'd write down their names, and I'd talk for 2 or 3 hours. And they introduced me. The first time they introduced me at the seminary, they said, "Now he will make you mad for the first 20 minutes because you'll think he's the most arrogant person you've ever met in your life. But after that, you'll love him because I'm so young, and I'm 58. Now you look at a 58-year-old guy. If you realize I'm a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, you're supposed to be dating, experimenting, sports, movies, that kind of world. I'm in theology school. People, maids now, going to learn, and I'm teaching them because I know more about these people than the folks who are the professors." And so that's how I lived. And so that's how I lived my life. So I'm not your typical way people live life.
Yeah. And then that is the Lord.
Totally.
Right.
Because I'm not that smart.
Yeah.
I just know how to read and flow and function.
But it's, I came to faith later in life, but I can see that, you know, God reveals the truth of the word to us, right? It's the most amazing thing. How can you read the same thing over and over again and it continually give you something and it open itself up more? Of all of these great people, I'm just pointing to your books here, of all these great people in the generals, do you have, I wouldn't say a favorite, but is there somebody that you're most intrigued with more than the others, or is it pretty much everyone? Or,
well, everybody's unique because they're all special. I've studied about 500 different preachers, so I can rattle off quite a few, but these are the most popular names. For me, there's two. My most favorite revival is the Salvation Army, which is very odd for people to think. But the Salvation Army is an amazing move of God that people don't know about, because we just know in the days of the bell ringers at Christmas time, or the social justice people that bring the food and the clothes. And it's great, but they were actually a salvationist army. They wanted you to get saved, and all this was secondary. And the other one was Catherine Kuhlman, because I met her and saw her as a little boy. So I knew Brother Roberts, I knew Brother Sumrall, I knew some of the folks in some of the books. But Catherine Kuhlman, for me, is the greatest preacher I've ever seen in my life. And I've seen, now, most of them in America, Canada, and around the world. Some names that we wouldn't know that are absolutely phenomenal men and women of God overseas. But Miss Kuhlman had more of God than anybody I've ever seen. You could push Oral and Hagen together and she still wins. You could push some others together. And this woman from Concordia, Missouri, that talked funny with red hair, divorced, had more of God's power and presence than I've seen of anybody. When you're in a Kuhlman meeting, you see stuff happen. I mean, you see blind and deaf and cripples get up and walk out. Not one or two, but when I was in their service, there was probably 40 to 50 people got up out of wheelchairs and walked off. And I saw it. It's nothing that, you can't pay that many people to do that. There's no gimmickry here. It's the real thing. But in her meeting, it's not what you saw was the most important. It's what you felt. You could feel the weight of his presence, and you could hear the sound of his presence in her meetings. And it would last three, four, five hours sometimes.
Wow.
And as a kid, you didn't go to the bathroom. You didn't want to play there. You're all live. You're watching this. You feel it. It's amazing. And when she quit, I got mad. Why'd you quit? We've been there for 4 hours and you're a kid. So, you know, meeting her in the green room as a child, the bigger the life, white dress and you know that when she walk in. And then watching her on stage, but what you felt and you saw in her service would be the two that stand out. Now, there's others I would give special mention to, but those are the two that I would, if I could make a decision to go back and be in what revival, I would join the Salvation Army when General Booth and his wife, Catherine, were in charge of it. It's a great time.
Now, I'm just on what you just said there. I'm not patronizing you, but the very first time I saw you speak last year at the Timothy Conference, didn't know who you were, but you spoke, and I'm the type of person, if you're speaking, you got to be real good, because after 20 minutes, I just, in my brain, check out.
Yeah.
And you spoke well over an hour and a half, and then you said you were done, and I'm thinking, what do you mean you're done? Keep going. Like, it was just so... You also have that. So friends, if you get a chance to see Roberts, I encourage you to check that out. Who are some names that are less familiar?
My books are in history?
Yeah, just in history. I mean, you know, people know John G. Lake and all these, you know.
A lot of the full gospel people don't know the evangelical people. The evangelical people don't know the full gospel people. Like, you can go back into time. Martin Luther, the great Protestant reformer, that name would be familiar, but a phenomenal story. But John Huss, that prophesied the advent of Martin Luther, people don't know about him. John Wycliffe, the morning star of the Reformation, that with him, he got kicked out of the church because he read the Bible and said, there's some problems here, we should fix this, and they kicked him out. They didn't kill him, because usually back then they killed you if you didn't obey the Catholic rule. And when he died a natural death, which was shocking. And they dug him up 44 years after he was dead because his writings and his teachings were still echoing and still moving forward, because they thought if he died, it would end. But the word of God does not end. It's eternal. It keeps living. And they were still so mad with him that they gave an order, dig up his bones. Now, you've been dead for 44 years, so there's not much left but bones, hair, teeth, and skeleton. All right, let's just be honest. I know it sounds gross, but put the picture. You're gone. There's no facial features left. They're still mad, and they dig up your bones and your teeth and crush them down and set them on fire, turn them into ashes, and throw them in a river to get rid of you. Well, the joke is the river they threw him in went out to the ocean and went around the world. So when you tried to get rid of him, he went around the world. So the point about John Wycliffe, would anybody care 4 weeks after you're dead that you were alive?
Not likely.
4 months?
All right.
44 years, they were still angry enough to pull up his remains and do that to it. That's a tremendous story. I like all those stories. I like Amy Carmichael, the young lady from Great Britain that wanted to go to, I think it was China, but ended up in India. And she was one of the first lady missionaries to go in there to help the children. And when she was a little girl, she believed God could do anything, and she wanted... blue eyes. I have blue eyes. You have brown eyes. She had brown eyes, and she wanted blue eyes. So she prayed and said, I want blue eyes, Father. And had all the belief that when she woke up in the morning, her eyes would turn blue.
Wow.
And they were still brown. And she had a little Jesus problem for a bit, worked it out. But later in life, when she goes to India, she goes to this village where she was assigned to work. And they had a tradition that every family would give one of the children to the temple for life, as a temple slave, sex, work, whatever. And this was the tradition that had gone on for hundreds of years. And the torture of the children and that would just bother her. And she went to the priest and said, stop this. No. Went to the families. No, we don't want the gods mad at us. But it wouldn't leave her. What do I do about those poor children? So she went and got coffee grounds, rubbed them on her face so she would look a little browner instead of a white British girl. Wore the dress like the Indian lady, the sari dresses. And would go into the temple and put a little boy, a little girl underneath her dress and walk out and begin to slowly bring children out. If God would have answered her prayer that day when she was a little girl and turned her eyes from your color to mine, they could have spotted her as she went into the temple to bring out the little kids from slavery. Sometimes when God says no, it's because he knows something about your future. The answer to this request and this desire is no. It's not because he's mad at you or you've done something wrong. He just knows your future. And the answer is no. So if people are watching and listening and you have a Jesus problem because you got to know, think of Amy Carmichael. She was so thrilled. As an adult working with the children, her eyes were brown so she could help bring the kids out from their bondage. God sometimes says no, not because he's mad. He withholds no good thing from you, the Bible says. So when he says no, it's a good thing. You may not know what it is, but you will in time. I love her story. I love David Livingstone's story. How he went to map out the interior of Africa because the outsides of Africa or the edges of Africa have been mapped by all the explorers, but the interior, there was no maps for the rivers and the mountains and the tribal people. And so he was Scottish. And he says, I'm first a minister of the gospel for I'm an explorer because the world knows him as the great African explorer. And he goes to Africa, maps out the interior, spends years away from his family. His first visit to Africa, a lion bites his face, and there's a scar on his face if you see a picture of him, and shakes him, and for some reason lets him go and walks off. I jokingly say maybe it was one of those angels that helped Daniel that got a little late for David Livingstone, but he got there just in time for didn't kill him, but he didn't die. And when he did die in Africa many years later, he died close to Zambia and Zimbabwe over there. There's the Livingstone tree. They declared him an African. He was an African. There was a white man. He was an African. And they shipped his body back to England, and they were doing the preparation for the burial. And they noticed scars from his wrist almost to his shoulders on both arms, these scars. And they went through his journal and his speeches that he gave about his traveling, but he never mentioned what this was. And so there was a little African native boy that came with the body just to make sure it was okay. And they went out to him and said, what is this? And he had made blood covenant with the different chiefs. So when the military and the white missionaries would come in, they wouldn't be at war with them. He mixed blood covenants, so people coming into the middle of Africa would be considered a friend and not a foe. So the life of Livingstone was just not the maps. He shed his own blood like Christ did for us, to make peace for people coming. It's a great story.
Wow.
So I can go on all day to tell stories like this. So
yeah, but, and I've let it go. I want to, this is supposed
you
to
have
be,
to stop me because I can go all the time. It's okay.
So, okay. Let's just jump back a little bit to, when was there sort of a transition? You were like teaching people about the Bible. When was there, or maybe you do both now, but when was the transition from, say, let's say, regular preaching to when you started preaching what you do today with God's generals? When did that occur?
I always preach the scriptures first and would tell the generals as a secondary, because my call is to teach spirit life, teach the generals, and then and talk about the heaven experience. That's the three things. I'm in that order. So what has happened the last, say, 10 years, a new generation, the one that Christ told me about, there will come a generation who will want to know they've showed up. And so all of a sudden, that's just become the biggest thing about me. And so I've accepted it is going to be like this for a while, but I still preach the other when I'm given the chance. I'll return like I do that. But usually I preach in light of revival history, light of the scriptures, and help people prepare for it scripturally, not just historically. And so I do both. So I've been doing both kinds of, most people know my preaching more than the generals up until about 10 years ago. Now everybody thinks I'm just the general's guy. They haven't heard the other side. So the older crowd goes, wow. So they know both sides of me.
Right.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, totally. So how is this not affected, but your personal life, as you've been doing this for years and years, actually, you know, how has this affected your personal life, your personal time, family, and stuff like that?
You have very little. I'm not married, so I have a lot more time than people that are married. And so I've been to 128 countries of the world that I've spoken personally.
Wow.
I've done some of those multiple times. I have built churches and Bible schools. I've done stuff, and I travel all the time. And so that is part of the price I paid, that I did not go to that part of my life as of yet. I may never. I don't know. I'm not trying to stay single. I'm not trying to get married. I'm just living and I'm happy. And so that's how I've lived. And so you could not do what I've done being married with children. And so, like I say, you can't follow my life as the normal life that you would follow as an example, because mine is so radically different than most people, even this way. And I don't feel like I've been deprived. I don't feel like I've, I don't feel negative about it. For me, it's great. I'm not trying to be Paul Jr. I'm not trying to be that. I'm just being Robert Sturdivant, living my life. And I told the Lord, when I get lonely, then get me married. And so that's kind of where I'm at the moment. And so I've been like this for all my life, and I have... I don't have a lot of time to do what a lot of people do with friends and things. I do have some friends, but I'm busy. I'm content. I'm doing this. And so that's my answer to that question.
Well, I guess your friends, too, would be within what you're doing.
Like yeah, Bill and stuff. I'm trying to have friends, a few friends outside my bubble. Because I've found out in years gone by, if all you do is live inside your bubble, that's not healthy either. So I have friends that are not as aware of all that I do, like you are talking about. They know in general what I do, but they're my friend. They're not connected to me because of my preaching gift or my right. authors. We became friends and they discovered this later.
Right.
So it's a whole different world. So I value those friendships because they're rare for me. And so for me to go home and not have anybody around is peace. For me to go home at holidays, it's great because I'm gone all the time. And I'm with people all the time. So my holiday desires are exact opposite than everybody else. They want to go somewhere. They want to do something. I want to go home and not have a schedule and not have a lot of friends or people around that want to talk or do something. And if I do have somebody around, like the few friends, they don't talk history. They don't talk pray for my dead kidney. They don't talk like that. It's a whole different world. That's what I live in all the time. Enjoy it. But it's a little different for me, if that makes sense.
Sure, and it's nice to have friends that aren't so in tune with what you're doing, so you can just go and just be with them instead of them asking you all kinds of stuff like I'm asking you right now.
I enjoy it, but sometimes you just want to watch a movie.
Yeah.
Or you just want to go do something, and sometimes I just don't. I know what, after 40-some years of doing this, I normally know what people are going to ask me before they ask me. I kind of know the outline of what's going on, so... I do get bored, not with you, but I get bored with people asking the same questions all the time.
Yeah.
And so there's a part of that challenge. You have to keep yourself socially and mentally exercised in all ways, or you become kind of a weird, exclusive type of odd Christian. And I never want to be that. I want to be as balanced and as relatable as a man and as a Christian, and not an elite, super spiritual, weird something, because that to me is not spirituality. That's religiosity to me.
Yeah,
that's my interpretation.
Have you had some companionship that didn't work out, or have this not even happened
twice? And I was really going to get married, and then they were attacked by church people, and she came to me and talked to me. She says, "If this happens all the time, I will divorce you. I know my temperament. And you're called to do this. I can't do this with you." And that was one of the biggest dramatic heartbreaks I've gone through privately. That may also be the reason why I just kind of keep certain things a certain way. I love the church. They've been good to me my whole life. But they've also had a few times where they were very mean, like this one, where it caused a problem that I could not resolve through time and through discussion. And so those are issues like that, to be honest.
Yeah. What about family? What about your dad?
My dad came back around when I was 15 years old. He was remarried. He was gone for, 7-8 years? We didn't know if he was dead or alive. He just disappeared.
Completely gone.
Just disappeared. So he shows up one day in front of our home in his vehicle with my stepmother. I didn't even know, you know. And so we begin to have visitation weekends with him at times and like that. And so we begin to develop that. But by that time, I've already begun a certain part of my life and my ministry. He was very supportive. He came back to the Lord. He would come to my meetings when I would speak in Tulsa and sit on the front row and cry. And he would cry because he could not forgive himself for what he had done. And I told him, I said, "Dad, it's all over. I mean, it's fine. I mean, we can't go back and fix it. Let's move forward." But he could not process that. And so we had the best. He would die when I was in my early 30s. He had a heart attack and was diabetic, and he had not taken care of himself. So the wages of not taking care of himself took him out early. He's in heaven. I'll see him again. But that's the story of my father.
Yeah. Yeah. What about your mom?
My mom just died 4 years ago, about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago. And she worked as my executive vice president for 37 years.
Wow.
She had two masters and a doctorate in higher administration and education. So her brain could run anything. She was that smart. So I was able to let her run the ministry because she could do it naturally and spiritually. She knew what to do naturally, and she could cast out a devil at the same time. She had both of those worlds combined together. And so I could go overseas and stay for 3 or 4 months and not ever go home because my mom ran everything, ran the money, ran, organized it, kept it together. So even though I was gone sometimes months at a time, because in my early days, I just go to Africa and stay for 3 or 4 months. I go to Europe and just stay because that's what I did.
Yeah.
And I loved it. You're young and you're having the adventure of a lifetime and you're doing it for the Lord and you're meeting all kinds of people and experiencing life and experiencing God to move. And we just go. And that's why some nations I'm more popular than I am in America, because I've spent more time there and they're smaller. So you can become a bigger voice faster in smaller nations. And there are some people that I'm actually closer to overseas than I'm here, because I've spent time with them and became friends. And I'm actually really a part of their family. They call me Uncle Roberts or Daddy Roberts. I'm in the family. So they invite me to the birthday party like I live next door. Like, it's across an ocean. But that's how close we are. So I've tried in my travels not to be the American superstar, like we can come across. I've tried to be your friend. Because when I'm at this age back then, I want to be able to be the friend of your son and his family. And when I'm real old, I want to be the friend of your grandson and die among that generation. You can't do that by being an arrogant, loud, stardom American preacher. You've got to be the friend of the people.
Yeah.
And you got to get out of that, and you got to go to their homes. You go eat their food. You know the name of their children. You go spend time with them. And I purposely did that. So that's why all over the world, I mean, I can leave America and Canada and be gone for 10 years and be busy every day overseas. I never have to come home because I worked like that. I've been in 128 countries.
It's amazing.
And they're not all the big, nice countries. Some of them are small, rough countries, you know.
Yeah.
That's what Jesus does. He went everywhere preaching.
Yeah. Is there a country, I mean, obviously you'd have the peace of the Lord, but is there a country that was pretty sketchy or hectic that you've been to?
Well, yeah, I was in Mozambique during the war and got shot at for 15 minutes. That was my first mission, my second missions trip to Africa. So I've had been that. I went through the Chernobyl nuclear cloud when that blew up. I was over in Eastern Europe when it came through.
Wow.
So I did that. I was in the Philippines during one of their coups. I was in the Persian Gulf before the first Gulf War and the PLO bomb threatened our airplane. So I've had all kinds of fun things. I mean, I don't talk about it because it's just, it's life and it happened. But when you get those kind of questions, I mean, I can list them. And
yeah.
But, you know, when you live life, it's just called living. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, if that's, you know, just what you do.
Then you look back on like, oh, my God, I did go through all that. How did I do that?
Yeah.
You know, I was in the Burmese jungle helping the Karen people where the Burmese were trying to genocide those people. And so I was back in those jungles. And then you go from the jungles of Burma to the presidential suites of the hotels in Singapore the next week. And the extremes of bathing in a river, eating barking deer and iguana, to a five-room presidential suite with a butler within a week of each other. The emotional pull.
Yeah.
I died. That week killed me because you want to go one way and you got, and that's the week that I died. Whatever. I can sleep in whatever. I can eat whatever. I can go whatever. And that's why I still live. So one day I'm in the big old suite hotel with a limo.
Yeah.
The next I'm in the back of a Toyota truck going down some dirt road in some small country.
Hiding.
Yeah. Just that's life.
Yeah. Well, the Chernobyl cloud does sound like a fun time.
You wake up and you hear the news and you go to the embassy like, it's here in 3 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's when you can't really hide. You can't get out fast enough. You just pray, Lord, yeah, I need you to protect me, that nothing will hurt me or anything will get into my system to cause cancer or something in the future. So it's been years and I'm okay.
Yeah.
And that's how I really pray. I really trust the Lord. If you obey the Lord, he protects you and he insulates you to where you actually enjoy what looks terrible. And you look back on like, how did I eat and do that? You're graced. That's the only way you can do some of that.
Yeah.
I'm an American. I like all my American stuff. I like my American food, my American comfort, but I've not lived in all of that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Your sister,
Yes.
You still get to see your sister. Yeah, what does she do?
She works in my office with me. She's a part of the team. Her husband died about a year ago, so we've had some deaths in our family in the last few years. Hmm. So the only one left of the immediate, when you hear me tell the story, the only ones left of that is me and my sister now. Mom, stepdad, my real father is gone, my grandmother's gone, and her husband, Mike, has passed away. So it's just back to us. So I've told her, I said, we can be creative for holidays. It's just us. We've got cousins and aunts and uncles and things like that, but our immediate family is not what it was. And so she's spirit-filled. She used to be my youth pastor in my church in California. And with the death of her husband, she's kind of coming back into her calling and come back into some of those things. So I think that a year or two, you'll probably see her out with me preaching.
Yeah.
That's my goal.
She have kids?
No kids.
No kids.
We're kidless. I mean, we should adopt some or something, but they didn't have any children.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Roberts, I'd love to just sit here and talk to you all day, but I just want to respect your time. I know you preached today, and you really went for it for a long one, I hear, which is awesome.
Or Robert's life story for about 2 hours.
Yeah. So I think some rest would be appropriate for you, but I'll have one final question for you, but everyone, to check out Roberts is all over social media. So you can check him out on Instagram, Roberts_Lairden_official. There's a Roberts Lairden Ministries Canada, so a Canadian division of that office. Canadian office. You can email that info@rlmcanada.com. The website is robertslairden.ca, and of course robertslairden.org. That'd be your main one.
Yes.
And on there, friends, you can there's some YouTube videos of sort of a more lengthy in depth testimony of Robert's testimonies. You can see all his books, online courses, live teachings, and the vault, which is diving deeper into.
Yeah, that's my collection going electronic. We're getting that. So everybody, you can't come to Florida and see everything, so we can, you know, make it electronic and put it on the internet so everybody can see it.
Yeah.
Plus it preserves it.
Yeah, that's awesome. We'll have all the particulars in the description. But a final question for you, Roberts. Of all the 128, you said, countries you've been to, is there a country that you haven't been to that the Lord's put on your heart to go to?
A country I've been wanting to go to is Luxembourg. I've been to every country in Europe but the little small Luxembourg. I like to go preach there. I want to go to Cuba. That's a desire to go to Cuba. And we're just now starting. I've been to all these countries and never been to Central and South America, if you can believe that. Hmm. I have books in Central and South America. So I think my time to come to Central and South America is about to hit. We're beginning to make inroads into Brazil, to Bolivia, Colombia. So we're starting to go in. So that's what's happening.
Do you have any kind of a feeling for South America? Well, what you'd like to share with them?
It's growing. I want their preachers to be more successful by knowing the reasons why others made mistakes. And so if they could learn from that and put signposts in their life or make the right turn so they don't go through the same mistakes. Because I think South America knows how to get the anointing. It's how to live in it is important. And how to live a life under that anointing and not make a misstep. And if you do make a misstep, he'll give you a second chance. Everybody great has made a mistake, and God still believes in them. Some people might not, but God does, and you can have a second chance.
Amen.
Amen.
Thank you very much, Roberts.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, appreciate your time. Friends, I'd encourage you to check out the website and check out some of these books on the history of God's generals that Roberts has written about. And if you get an opportunity to go see him speak, I really encourage you to see him speak. Great history there, and definitely a man called by the Lord to share all that stuff with us all and to help us see revival. Again, I say it often, but the Lord's waiting for us, friends. Let's go. Special thanks today to Lakeshore Pentecostal Camp in Cobourg, Ontario, for letting us use the space. Jacob Walda and Bill Prankard from BPEA for setting this all up. Caden Carlton for technical support and video. And of course, Dr. Roberts Laridan. For Disciple of City, I'm Todd Carlton. We'll see you next time.